Let's see what the stew has in store for us today.
Welcome to the Gnomecast, Gnome Stew's tabletop gaming advice podcast. Here we talk with the other gnomes about gaming things to avoid becoming part of the stew, but I guess we'd better be good. This episode is brought to you by awesome Patreon backers like the astounding Amadeo Rosa, the generous GM Gerrymander, and the kindred Kathleen Helpert. Today we have myself, Ange, along with JT and guest Alex Thomas, and we are going to talk about running versus playing. No, not GMs versus players. That's a whole different conversation. We're going to talk about the skills needed to run versus the skills needed to be a good player, and then some of the differences in what we like about both. Before we dive into that main topic, though, we are going to ask our Get to Know a Gnome question, which is, since it's not our topic, let's talk about that last time you had an adversarial player or a GM. So what was one time that you had a player who treated you like an adversary or a GM who treated like you like an adversary? Alex, I'm going to go with you.
F that guy. I have a player in mind who I know Ange has had dealings with.
Oh, God.
There are no nice words for what he is. He is a whistle of various bodily functions.
Are we talking about worst Batman ever?
Yes, we're talking about worst Batman ever. And okay. Worst Moon Knight ever. And worst Nightcrawler ever. And worst Vulture ever. Actually, worst Vulture ever is what I'm going to talk about. So, my first impression with this player, he sat down at one of my one-shot convention games and saw that Sam Wilson was Captain America, and he said, "Ew, Sam Wilson is here. Can we kill him first?" And that was his introduction to me as a human in this world that we live in.
Oh, wow.
He sat down, he picked up Moon Knight. I have this ritual at the beginning of all my convention games where I say, "I'd like to go around the table and ask everybody who they're playing and what their name is so that I can refer to you either in character or out of character if I need something from you." And I got to him, and he said, "My name is Mark Spector, and I'm playing Mark Spector." And I know for a fact that he probably does this in order to avoid GMs finding out his name so that they can get his tickets pulled at events. Because every time I've played with him, he has been crude and misogynist and disruptive to the other players and just the kind of player that is just only interested in their own enjoyment of what's happening and not anybody else's, which is the worst kind of player, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had the displeasure of playing with him not too long ago, and he ruined the game of a very good GM who did his damnedest to try and mitigate this guy's behavior, but he was definitely doing everything for his own fun and ignoring everyone else.
Oh, no.
He really was the worst Batman ever.
Yeah, when he played Vulture, he was very excited about being Michael Keaton Vulture because he has a hot black wife. But his plan to attract Spider-Man was to grab a baby out of a stroller and throw him into the air next to the Daily Bugle, because obviously Spider-Man would never let a baby hit the ground.
Wow.
Yeah, that sounds like him. So, JT, what's one of your adversarial experiences?
All right, I'm actually going to talk about a little player v. player. When I first moved to Colorado Springs, one of the very first things I did was hit all the local game stores that had a cork board. Early days of internet, so cork board. And pinned up my, name and phone number, said looking for games and yada, yada, yada. If somebody already had something pinned up, I wrote down their information or took a little tear tab with the phone number or whatever. Connected up with a guy named Charles, who I'm still great friends with today. Him and his wife, they were girlfriend at the time, boyfriend, girlfriend at the time, but anyway, and he had arranged Vampire the Masquerade game at someone else's house, not his house, because he had found a player who had a mentally challenged son, autism, pretty deep on the spectrum of autism, and the son could not handle strange environments, so we had to play at her house. Unfortunately, her house, in air quotes, was somebody else's house, and she was just renting the basement. The landlord required himself to be involved if we're going to game at his house, even though he wasn't originally involved in the game group formation. He didn't want to be left out because he couldn't find a good game group to play with. Turns out he found plenty of good game groups. He was the bad player that got ejected from all these good game groups.
I know the type.
Yeah, so now we're essentially stuck for valid reasons at his house gaming there. He was horrible. He was horrible. He rolled his dice on the AOL chat dice roller. He wouldn't roll physical dice. And his computer was like stashed in the corner with the monitor turned away from everybody. So you couldn't actually see the dice rolls. And Charles was the game master for the vampire game, and Charles handled it wonderfully. But the end of the campaign, which ran a very brief period of time, maybe 5 months, maybe, because we had to get the hell out of there. We had to get away from Dude. But it was a lot of player-on-player conflict at the end, because we had aligned ourselves with different factions, and the guy kept rolling like all tens to hit me. And Charles just on the fly would be like, cool, but your weapons are ineffective against the magical ensorcelled what trench coat that JT's character is wearing. And the guy in the corner was like, how the hell did he get that? And I was very quietly internally going, how the hell did I get that? Because Charles just made it up on the fly that his quote unquote all tens to hit me were, bullshit. So, yeah.
Oh, those are Malkavian tens.
Yes, there you go. There you go. So it basically, as soon as that story arc wrapped up, we bailed. I felt so bad for the poor lady that we had to bail on that had the autistic son, but it was super not fun. And we openly invited her and her son to come, to like my house or Charles's house or something like that and get acclimated to see if he could chill there while we gamed. And we tried that, but his mental challenges wouldn't allow for that, unfortunately. So we tried. We tried.
I do hope in modern times she was able to find online gaming that would accommodate, I mean, obviously this is
Sure.
many years in the future, but I do hope she found the ability to game online once that started becoming a thing.
Right. I hope so too. This was 20, almost 27 years ago. So things
Yeah.
have evolved in the world and gaming and online and all that since then. So.
Yeah. So for me, it's the player was not nearly that level of monster, but it was definitely a player who thought the game had to be played player against the GM. I was running a one-shot for Cubicle 7 at Origins. It was a game of Lone Wolf, which was a system they had put out based on some choose-your-own-adventure novels from the 80s. It was early in the morning. I was doing this as a favor for fellow gnome Walt Chnowski, and I do not do morning games, but Walt needed a GM to pick up this session at 9 a.m. on a Thursday, and I'm like,
Oof.
okay, I'll be there. And I show up, and I've got four players, and they all pick their characters, and this is a very simple scenario. It's like these characters are novices. They are being sent out from their training home. I don't know if it was a monastery, but something like that. Their training home sent off to investigate a missing caravan. They are supposed to leave their home, travel through the woods, arrive at a caravan crossroads location, question what happened, and then go find the missing caravan. Very simple, very straightforward.
Yeah, pretty straightforward there.
Yeah, it's an introductory adventure to a new system. So they travel through the woods, they have an encounter in the woods, they get to the location, and they start doing their investigating, and this one guy just dug in his feet and kept investigating, kept investigating, kept talking to this person, kept talking to this person, kept talking to this person. And the other players are like starting to get a little antsy, so I'm starting to throw some stuff their way and throwing some, trying to get them moving, but he just refused to stop investigating in this one location. And I'm sitting here going, I don't, I'm starting to run out of time. Even if I get them
Right.
to leave and get on the road to go follow in the caravan's tracks to find out where it got waylaid, we're already 2.5 hours into this session. I've only got a viable hour or so left before we need to wrap things up. So I ended up having to completely on the fly rearrange this whole scenario so that just across the river, across a bridge, was a small town, and they could actually find the caravan had been waylaid not far across the bridge, and all the stuff was in the town, and the bad guys were there, and they could fight them. And it's like all the rest of the players said they had a good time, got up, left, and like he stood there for a second. And he's like, well, this wasn't bad, but it was way too much of a railroad. And then just turned around and walked away. And I'm just like,
Wow.
Tomb of Horrors was like Vietnam for a certain generation of gamers.
I'm just like, dude, do you know how much of this scenario I had to rewrite for you?
Right.
Like, this is nothing like what was written on the page. There was no, I mean, it's a convention game. It's not going to be a whole branching, you know, convoluted plot line. It's like you've got a missing caravan. Go find the missing caravan.
Right, right.
If I was railroading you, you would have said thank you at the end.
Right.
So let's move into our main topic. There's a lot of discourse out there offering advice to GMs, but not quite so much for folks to be better players. It's obvious that the two different sides of the table have related but different skill sets. So we're going to take some time to talk about the difference between the two. First, though, we're going to talk about the differences between games that we like as player versus GM. So first question is do you find that there is a difference between the types of games you like to play versus the types of games you like to run? JT, I'm going to start with you.
All right, playing versus running. I'm okay playing or running almost anything, honestly. I'm polygamer, so I will sit down. However, if it's a dice pool mechanic, the die has to be larger than a D6. because one step of difficulty on a D6 is 16-point-something% more or less difficult. That is too large of a stair step in difficulty or ease for me. Just mathematically, it's stupid. There's no other way to put it. Sorry, Shadowrun people, you need to use D8s or D10s or even, oh my gosh, D12s, right? Put some D12s to work there.
I spent a lot of my career saying Shadowrun is a great setting that needs a game.
I totally agree. Totally agree. I love the setting of Shadowrun. It's brilliant. But, oh my God, a D6 dice pool? No, no. It you may as well use a D4 dice pool and just call it a day. Putting that aside, my only types of games that I don't like running as Game Master are games with a compel mechanic, like the Fate. Yes, I know I'm giving them a Fate point for in exchange for the compel. There's some benefit to it and all that. But I don't feel comfortable telling a player what their character is or is not going to do or how the character does or does not feel or is going to react or act. I feel like I'm overstepping my bounds. Mm-hmm. And I know that's the point of a compel. There's a social agreement there that the Game Master of Fate will step in and do compels, and the players need to accept it or not. But I don't like it. I don't like it.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. I have my own issues with Fate. I think the thing with compels is it's supposed to be you are compelling something that is already on the character sheet.
Right.
So it is something the player has already agreed to.
Oh, yeah.
It's just the timing may be inopportune, which is, kind of supposed to be the point.
Correct. Correct. I just don't feel comfortable doing it. Also, my capability for memorizing lists of things, even shopping lists, is almost nil. So in Fate, they have what primary concept, it's called something else, and what, three aspects and a trouble. So there's like five things per character you got to remember, and you got four characters. That's 20 things, not counting my stuff.
Yeah.
Ain't going to happen. Ain't going to happen. And I know I could have cheat sheets hanging on the GM screen to refer to and all that, but it introduces latency to the game when I'm running the game because of the way my brain doesn't work properly for memorizing things. So yeah. So that's kind of my one thing is the compel. And I don't mind fate points. Love, you know, meta currency for mm-hmm. games like the Savage Worlds Benny or Inspiration in D&D. If it's not binary, we always did max 3 for D&D 5 Inspiration. You could have up to 3 Inspiration mm-hmm. as opposed to just it being on or off. Yeah, I love in-game meta currency type stuff. I just don't like the compel part of it.
How do you feel when the compel comes from the player side? Like if a player offers up, this could be related to my trouble. If you want to do that, GM, in exchange for rewarding me.
I love that. I love that. Yeah. Because that puts the onus of memorizing the list of 5 on the player, because that's easier to do. And I played Fate, and I can manage to wrap my head around my own 5 aspects, but I can't do 20 or 15 or whatever, right? But no, I love it when the player would step up and go, hey, I have this thing that would be is you know negative to me or might be beneficial in this situation that you didn't think of. I'm like, cool, let's run with it, right? I haven't run enough Fate for that to come up too often, though, just because of my dislike of the compel.
I get that.
Yeah, I get a lot of practice with it in Mutants and Masterminds.
Oh, there you go.
I have a reputation for extending devil's bargains and things like that to players.
So, Alex, what are some differences you find between the games you like to play versus the ones you like to run?
I've always sort of been a big proponent of running the games that you want to play.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't see as much difference in the things that I like on both ends. And this is a flaw I'm trying to overcome in my life, but I tend to run all the time. So I always run the games I want to play instead of getting a lot of experience on both ends. But I think for both of those instances, it's games that have a lot of room for the players to explore and room for the players to roleplay and room for just drama to happen between everybody at the table that is telling a good story as a group.
For me, there are games I'm willing to play with certain GMs that I have no desire to run. I love your Mutants and Masterminds games, Alex. I don't want to run Mutants and Masterminds. It's a little too much for me. Same with Shadowrun. If there's a GM I like who wants to run Shadowrun, I'll totally play Shadowrun. It's nothing I'm going to seek out. It's too complicated, too crunchy. And I know Alex and I have mutual friends who would yell at me for calling Mutants and Masterminds complicated, but there are a lot of moving parts that I can find a little overwhelming as a GM.
The branding team of Mutants and Masterminds would have a problem with me letting you say this.
Like, I know. Frame of comparison, like, back in the 90s, it's people would play, you know, Hero System, Champions, and, like...
Oh, yeah.
Mutants and Masterminds is a breeze compared to that.
Yes, it is.
But it's still just a little beyond the effort that I feel I want to put into games, if that makes sense.
Yeah, there's a gulf between character creation and getting to know the rules and gameplay. That's not what this podcast is for, but it's something that I'm working on with future M&M stuff in mind.
So there's a lot of games that I'll play that I don't have any desire to run, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, total sense.
We've kind of covered these questions, but I'm looking at specific games that you enjoy running but haven't wanted to play.
Oh, that's tough. I don't think I've ever run into a game that I enjoy running that I don't also enjoy playing. But I think that's the sunk cost fallacy, where I've spent all this time learning the rules, and now I want somebody to do the easy part. Let me do the easy part.
I will say that there are some Powered by the Apocalypse games that I enjoy running, but I have found I don't enjoy playing. And that may be because I have run too many of them. So I start kind of chafing at the, I don't want to be a backseat GM, but I start thinking of all the things I would do.
Right.
Monster of the Week is probably the one that's my biggest roadblock, so to speak. If I'll play it, and there's certain GMs that do a great job with it, but there's other times where I'm just like, I would do this totally differently. Yeah. I really wish we were doing this a different way. And it's like, the last thing you want to do is be a backseat GM.
Right. Yeah. So enjoy running, but don't enjoy playing. I think the closest on my list is going to be Cyberpunk of any flavor, whether it's Cyberpunk 2020, Red, Cities Without Number from Kevin Crawford, or anything in that genre. I love Cyberpunk so much that there's a certain set of feels that go into Cyberpunk that few people are equipped to encompass and capture. To my satisfaction.
Yep.
And again, it's the whole backseat. And for me, it's not the mechanics or the running. It's kind of the world building, the setup and NPCs and all that good stuff. I just enjoy running Cyberpunk more than I enjoy playing it. Having said that, I've only played in like 2 one-shots of Cyberpunk and 1 brief-lived campaign. Well, not even brief, probably 8 months worth of Cyberpunk 2020. Because I begged a friend of mine to finally run Cyberpunk 2020 for me. As campaign style, and he ran it for our group, and I had a blast. But there were nuances in the world that were missing, and I didn't bring it up to him because he was doing a scale of 1 to 10, probably 7.5 to 8, right? So he's doing a really good job, enough to satisfy me and keep me happy. But there were some little nuggets missing here and there from the world building. And again, I've read I don't know how many Cyberpunk novels, and I've kept them all. I have 2 shelves worth of Cyberpunk novels behind me over there that I'm kind of looking at, and another full shelf of Cyberpunk role-playing material as well. So I just, it's one of my favorite genres.
What about you, Alex? Anything that you like running that you don't enjoy playing?
Not as much. I mean, this might be controversial, but I am happy to run a D&D game. I am seldom happy to play in a D&D game because I often find that D&D is the first game for a lot of new Dungeon Masters, and I find that there are just some quirks of running the game that people get hung up on, and then I get frustrated.
Yeah, I could see that.
Things like, please roll a check for everything.
Right.
Not just the important things, or, no, you can't do that. That's not what the rule says exactly. And just anything that puts me in a box where I'm subject to an uncreative GM, I am not happy to be. I'm not happy to be there.
Sure, sure.
Yeah, and this kind of falls into the reason I say I don't play D&D. I play a lot of D&D. I run a D&D podcast with Jared, Thacko with Advantage. I do not play D&D at conventions. And the reason is, you know, I joke, I don't play D&D at conventions because we have D&D at home.
Right.
But the real reason is I cannot guarantee the quality of game I'm going to get at a convention. And there is a vast difference in the quality of game you can get of D&D at conventions, from the GM who's just phoning it in, the GM who's just there to do murder hobo dungeon run type of thing, to, you know, it's really hard to tell what type of game you're going to get. I've actually also found a similar problem with superhero games at conventions, Alex. And for a while before I met you and some of the other Matinee Adventures folks who run Mutants and Masterminds, I was avoiding superhero games at conventions because I would get there and it would turn out to essentially be murder hobos, crunchy punch 'em up fight with no story attached.
Sure.
Those are never as much fun as I want them to be. So I kind of want to make sure that I at least get an idea that I'm going to get a good game from whoever's running the game.
Yeah, I definitely see that with superhero games too.
Yeah.
And with some superhero players who show up and they're like, oh, this isn't what I thought it was going to be when they sit down for one of my weird story-driven games. What do you mean Princess Leia, Samwise Gamgee, and Crypto the Superdog are my player choices? Get out of here.
That's everyone's Superman?
It's a Superman for all seasons. And it's like, I picked a Superman from every multiverse that I could think of and made them all be on a team together.
I love the concept of that game. I'm just sad I didn't get to play it.
I'll have to run it again. I thought you had to play it.
No, I missed that one. So let's talk about the skills you think that are necessary for a GM to develop that aren't as important for a player.
Aren't as important for a player.
Task switching. You're going to be hit from many different directions, sometimes all at once. And you've got to be able to go, okay, prioritize the request from the players, task switch between them so nobody gets bored, and which we call spotlight management, is the phrasing for that, right?
I call it plate spinning.
Plate spinning, there you go, yeah. And, make sure that everybody's either question, concern, or action is handled to their satisfaction. When I say satisfaction, I don't mean a positive result, but it needs to be somehow drawn up to a conclusion, whether it's swinging their sword or negotiating a new contract with the neighboring king or everywhere in between. The request from the player needs to be drawn to a close at some point.
I do think the GM also needs to have a solid handle on the mechanics of the game.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I don't think they need to be an expert by any stretch of the imagination. I think that's a fallacy that keeps a lot of people from trying to GM, but you need to still understand the general mechanics of the game and be able to make rulings on the fly.
Yeah, that's even more important.
Confident in saying, this is how this is going to work. This might not be how it works in the rules, but today it's going to work this way.
Yeah.
I'll go home and I'll research it. And then if it's different or I like this version better, we'll discuss.
Yeah. Yeah. Knowing the framework and general mechanics of the game allows you the freedom to make rulings on the fly.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't understand that baseline, you're going to have a rough time running the game.
Yeah. And I mean, I have completely stepped in to run a game that I barely understood. Usually I do this with friends. I don't do this at conventions that I've signed up to run a particular game and not have an understanding of it. But if I want to learn a game, I will sometimes run it with not all of the knowledge in place just to get a feel for what I'm doing wrong. I ended up doing that with Tales from the Loop. First time I ran it was mechanically was absolutely atrocious. Anyone who actually loved and knew the game would have looked at what I was doing and go, oh my God, what are you doing?
What are you doing?
But the players had a blast, and it taught me, like, oh, I get what this section of the book is now saying and how to do it correctly. I still, there was a whole thing on extended tasks that my brain just never grasped until like a year or two later when a mutual friend of Alex's and I's, Andy, was starting to run his, and he came to me with questions on how to run an extended task. And I'm like, Andy, you are so much better at the rules than I am. I have no idea what you're talking about.
Andy's great with rules. He's the guy. And the real trick is to infiltrate the RPG industry and become the developer of the game you love. So when you get something wrong, no, you didn't. That's a rata.
You're working on some alternatives.
Yeah, it's an omniversal variant, is what we call it.
Anything else you think a GM needs that a player doesn't really have to have?
I'm trying to think, because the plate spinning is a really good point. The being able to control pacing, knowing that it is part of your job as the GM to tap everybody on the head every 5 to 10 minutes or so just to make sure they know that you see them and you're coming to them, especially if the party splits up. Which I know is supposed to be rule number one, don't split the party.
Don't split the party. Actually, we should do an episode of the podcast splitting the party.
Because I have good stories about that.
Yeah.
Like positive outcome for the players when they split the party.
Yeah, because it's a fallacy that it's a never do this, because sometimes it is right. The thing to do it. But what I was going to say is it's not only pacing in knowing how to keep the game moving, but knowing when to pause and let the players sink their teeth into a scene.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I've gotten scolded before of trying to move things along too quickly when the players were still really into the role-playing.
Yeah, I think that listening is a GM skill that so many GMs need to develop, because sometimes it is best if you just sort of fade away for a minute and let them scheme and plot and talk about what just happened and sort of take some notes about what they think is happening, and maybe that is not what's happening if it's better than your idea.
Right? Yeah. Also, like, general... If you want to run story-driven games, you know, get beyond the hack and slash and murder hobo type level of playing, and you want to actually have, you know, some meat on the bone of the story, understanding story structure helps. And it doesn't have to be to the level that, like, Alex and I have as authors, because you kind of got to do deep dives into story structure to get your stuff square on writing fiction. If you read a lot of fiction, you will inherently understand that just by gut feel. Mm-hmm. It may not be a proper education in the subject matter, but you'll inherently learn it just by reading stories.
Yeah.
And if you want to shortcut things and you're like, I really don't like reading the 8,000 page Brandon Sanderson novels because he writes faster than I read type thing, you could probably hit Wikipedia and throw in, you know, like fiction story structures, and it's going to give you 6 or 7 or 8 different ones to read, and just skim the Wikipedia articles and get some ideas there. Mm-hmm. And that will help you better grasp your pacing of your story, how much meat goes in a scene, when to do a cut and move on to the next scene, things like that.
TVtropes.com is another great place to go.
Yeah.
Set a timer. Sorry.
Yeah, don't go down that rabbit hole.
That was reflex there. Yeah. TV Tropes is great, but set an egg timer for like 20 minutes. And when it goes ding, close that tab or the tabs that you have open. Because you will spend hours there.
It is a great place, though, to get ideas and to, like...
It really is.
They are tropes for a reason, and your players are not expecting you to reinvent the wheel with the stories you're telling.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
I think that's a trap that some GMs can get into, is they see a trope and they're like, I can't use this because it's a trope. And it's like, it's a trope for a reason. What you need to do is give it enough flavor and personality that it's still enjoyable to the players. Another aspect of the plate spinning that Alex mentioned is having the world view. As a GM, you need to be able to see the entire setting that the players are in and like be aware of what's going on that's not directly related to what the characters are doing. Don't do the thing where you have a sandbox and there's something important going on over there that the players decided not to engage with, and so the whole world's going to get destroyed because that thing is happening, unless you really telegraphed it and your players were rude and didn't go off after it. But it's like, keep things focused on the players and what their characters are doing, but be aware of what all the NPCs are doing.
Yeah.
Because that can help make the world feel more lived in as the players engage with it. So let's talk about players. I don't think we spend enough time talking about ways to be better players. But what are some things that the players need to be good at that aren't as necessary for the GM or help facilitate things for the game as a whole?
And that is such a shame that we don't talk about it more, because most of the time, my first advice for GMs who want to be good GMs is to find good players.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's hard to be a bad GM if you've got a table full of good players.
They'll do 90% of the work for you.
It's not impossible. Not impossible.
Right.
But
yeah. Yeah, good players really is a big lever bar to, you know, a force multiplier for a good game.
Well, it's like, JT, you talked about that guy whose house you used to game at, that you had to have him in your game, and he was just bad player.
Yeah.
There is sometimes this pushback against offering advice on how to be better players, because in the opposite side of that coin is people telling GMs, it doesn't matter what your players do, you need to accommodate them.
Yeah, no.
And that's not true.
I think that sort of boils down what I want to talk about as a skill for a good player, and that is learning how to fail gracefully.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Because the GM has to fail all the time. That's just the nature of the role of I'm the antagonist, the heroes are going to win. But you have to be able to have a relationship with your GM where you know that failure isn't the end state of your game.
Mm-hmm.
So if your character does fail, it doesn't necessarily mean that they die and the game is over. It just means that there is a new set of consequences and a new direction for the story to go that can be really fun and exciting to play with. But so many players are afraid to suffer that setback, to go through that failure.
I think it is also absolutely important for players to understand that it is also their job to help facilitate the fun for everyone at the table. You know, it's not just your fun and what you enjoy. Mm-hmm. And this is like the bad player that Alex was talking about. He obviously loves gaming. He loves playing for his own enjoyment. And part of his enjoyment is making everyone else at the table uncomfortable and miserable.
I don't care as long as I get mine.
Yeah. Whereas like the GM, the players that GMs want at the table are the players who know how to draw in other players and their characters into their shenanigans and make everything fun for everyone at the table.
Yeah, be inviting and be willing to be invited.
Yes.
Into shenanigans. Mm-hmm. I mean, the whole improv thing is, you know, if anybody's ever done improv acting, non-solo improv acting, where it's like you're playing off a group or another partner or something, is the whole yes and. And if you really have to say no to something for whatever reason, add a but onto that. You know, no, but how about this, right? Offer an alternative to, you know, go along with the new idea. And I really don't like no, but either. You know, I like the interesting idea, however, right? I like your idea, but let's twist it a little bit and change it up. What do you think? And see if they give you, and keep going back and forth until finally somebody says, yes, that's great, let's go do that.
I also think there's a luxury that players have that the GM doesn't necessarily have in, you can be in the moment, you don't have to be thinking about the next thing you're going to say as the player.
Sure.
And it's more organic, it's more natural to be present and to react to what's going on instead of just trying to be the clever character or the person who says the quippy one-liners. You should always know what you're going to do next in combat or on when your turn comes up in initiative, but don't feel like every conversation is a competition.
Following up on the know what you're going to do next in combat, which is really important, I will say I don't think it's necessary for you to completely understand a game when you start to play it, but if it's an ongoing campaign, you need to learn how your character works.
Oh yeah, that's key.
You know, you don't necessarily need to understand the whole system, but you need to understand how your character functions.
Yeah, this ties back to a GM idea too, where a good GM skill to develop is translating player nonsense into mechanics.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
Interpreting their statements into what do you really want to do?
What effect are you trying to achieve?
Yes.
Is occasionally what I'll ask a player if they say something to me, and I'm like, what did you just call me?
We had a long-running Ardenvale campaign, which is a mega campaign, mega dungeon. PDF is over 1,000 pages long. It's like five volumes or seven volumes printed, something like that. Anyway, the game master needed a break. He's like, I need a break from this because you guys have run out of the areas that I have read and I can't keep the whole thing in my head. And I was like, yeah, no shit. No kidding, right? So he's like, can we take a 2-month break from Ardenville? And is somebody willing to run something? Of course, he brings us up on Wednesday. Our game day is Saturday. And we're doing this via Discord. And I'm like, okay, fine. I'll fire it. But Stars Without Numbers, little mini campaign for the next 2 months. We'll do Stars Without Numbers starting Saturday. We'll do a session zero, go. And here we go. I read it when it first came out, but I hadn't touched it since. So it was cold knowledge. And one of my players came to me and said, hey, do you mind if we use psychic abilities? And I was like, there's psychic abilities in the book? I don't remember this, right? So I look at the table of contents. Sure enough, there's psychic abilities in there. I'm like, I don't remember that. So my response is yes, but you have to know the rules. So when you engage your psychic abilities, you tell me as the game master how they work, interact with the world, other people, other objects, blah, 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 all that. You master that little subset so I don't have to, and we're good. Because I only had like a day and a half at this point to come up with world and setting and a little intro adventure and all that. So, and refresh my memory of how the game system works. And he was cool. He was like, yeah, okay, done. So we had a little psychic action going on.
One of the largest values you can find as a GM is a player at your table who knows the game better than you do.
Oh, yeah.
And is willing to offer you input when you ask them questions.
Yes.
Yes. Not right. Unsolicited.
Not unsolicited.
But solicited input.
Yeah, don't be a rules lawyer and tell everyone how they're doing it wrong. But if the GM goes, hey, so-and-so, how do we do this thing? And you can be like, yeah, blah, 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 blah. And like, okay, we're good. We go.
Yep.
Let's move on to why is it good to keep both sets of skills sharp? Why should we do both? Why should we both GM and play?
It's more fun that way. Honestly, and also like my example with Ardenville, you never know when your game master is going to need to take a 2-month break.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to have to step up and, you know, flip to the other side of the screen to be the game master.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think both skills really complement each other and they feed
do.
Each
yeah.
other.
Yeah.
When you're better at one event, if you apply the right lessons, you'll be better at both so that you do get that sort of, how can I help the GM yeah. tell this story? How can I help my other players have a fun spotlight, you know? What is this player experiencing from that side of the screen? And are there ways for me to help deal with that anxiety? Are there opportunities I could present them?
Like you said, I think it's important for GMs to understand what the player's side of the screen is like. And I think it's good for the players to understand what the GM is going through. Because some of the problems I end up seeing in various gaming circles are A, GMs who never play because they never want to give up control. And they end up being kind of bad GMs because they don't think about what the player's experience is. Or players who never GM and think everything should be catered to them. You know, both sides of those can be a problem.
Yep.
Yeah. And you don't have to do both to be good at either one, but I think it really helps.
Like, I think you can be a great GM as long as if you don't enjoy playing as much, you prefer running, but you still have to keep in mind the player experience. Whereas the player, you need to understand that this is a lot of work that the GM is putting in for you.
Yep, totally agree. Knowing both sides of the equation allows you to be sympathetic to the other mm-hmm. side when you're on one side of it, right? You know the pitfalls, and you know when you can step yep. in and help.
Yep, exactly. My advice for GMs who are forever GMs, try and play once in a while.
Yeah, fill the well, yeah.
And for players who have never GM'd, it's something worth trying. You know, it is not as hard as it looks.
Oh, yeah.
It's not as hard as it looks, and it is definitely something to try once in a while. Any last words on player skills versus GM skills?
No, I think we covered it. I don't have anything else to add.
So let's get us out of here. This show is funded by the Gnome Stew Patreon. You too can Patreon backer by following the Patreon link, Gnome Stew website to the Gnome Stew Patreon. We love doing this, and our patrons help us keep it going. The Gnomecast is part of the Polygamers Podcast Network. So if you're enjoying us, here's another show you should check out.
Heroes of Hovel's Way. Are you ready to listen to an epic fantasy adventure of two best friends and their raccoon pal? Aramon, the dreaming paladin, and Odie, the starlight druid, travel the barony of Castakin to fight dirt. Join them as they clean up the slurred monstrosities of Valha Morris, the titan of Earth, on the Heroes of Hovel's Way, a D&D audio drama actual play. What? The raccoon? His name's Monty. He talks, and he loves chocolate chip cookies.
You can find all of us at GnomeStew.com, along with Gnome Stew on Facebook, Blue Sky, Instagram, and Threads. You can find Alex. Alex, where can we find you?
Oh, I'm around. If you if you go to AlexanderWrites.com, that's probably the best place to find what I'm up to. But I'm on YouTube and Twitch and all over the place.
I am going to give a shout out to a book I recently finished reading. I think I just shouted this out on Thacka with Advantage. So if you're listening to both shows, which you should be listening to both shows, you have already heard this, but it is called How to Become a Dark Lord and Die Trying by Django Wexler. It is a wonderful book. It is a mashup of, I think the manga term is isekai, which is basically somebody transported into a fantasy world, with also a little bit of Groundhog's Day. There are D&D references galore. It is a incredibly fun book that ends in a cliffhanger, and the next book is coming out in March. So I'm super eager for that book to come out. Also, I will be attending a very small gaming convention at the Genesee SUNY New York College campus in February called Running Gag. It is a long-running convention that's about 300, 400 people. It's a lot of fun. So if you're in the Western New York area, it's worth checking out.
And my shout outs for this episode, I've actually got two for everybody out there. Number one is a friend of mine, H.Y. Greger, finished and published her Russian themed urban fantasy set in the Milesian Accords universe, or world, I should say. It is the Vecnoy Saga, and the link will be in the show notes. I have all the books they're signed, and I've started delving into book number one, and it's a fun little romp, so I highly recommend it. And my second shout-out is from February 24th through the 26th in 2025. I will be in Colorado Springs at Cosine 2025. It's a cozy little specfic convention, a little bit of gaming, but mostly there for the speculative fiction, you know, your fantasy, your science fiction, your horror, all that good stuff. I'm going to be on three different panels, and the very first panel I'm on is the first panel of the day on Friday about being cruel to your characters. And the reason I'm bringing this up is that it's on the main stage, and I'm sharing that main stage with luminaries such as Connie Willis, Mary Robinette Kowal, Peter Sartucci, and Lawrence White Evans. They're all award-winning authors, whereas I'm not. And I got a bit of imposter syndrome going on about being up on the stage with those great and wonderful people. Having said all that, I have shared the stage with Connie Willis before, and she is fantastic. And I've known the other participants for the panel for a good number of years. So it's going to be a good time about talking about how to be cruel to your characters. And of course, this is fiction oriented, not role-playing oriented, but if you show up, you might learn a few tricks on how to be cruel to your PCs as well.
So do you guys think we have enough skills as both a player and a GM to avoid becoming thrown in the stew?
Oof, I don't know.